It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Like the Olympics and presidential elections, the Carnegie International comes around once every 4 years. And this exhibition of contemporary global art is also eagerly anticipated. It was begun in 1896 by Andrew Carnegie in an effort to find the old masters of tomorrow, as he told curators. The exhibition that opens October 4th at the Carnegie Museum of Art aims to present a bold and ambitious survey of the art of our time. I'm joined now in Studio A by the three Carnegie International 2013 curators, Daniel Bowman, Dan Byers, and Tina Kukalski. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Thank you.
Let me start with, I will let the lady go first, Ms. Kukalski. How would you describe this year's focus?
We've taken an approach where we've created a sort of a framework in which we've allowed the artists and the international to respond. So there are a number of different sort of elements of this framework. One is what you expect of the Carnegie International, which is in essence an exhibition of new international contemporary art composed of the voices from 35 different artists from 19 different countries. But there are some other components to this year's exhibition that are part and parcel of the whole, including an exhibition of the museum's permanent collection. Its modern and contemporary galleries have been reinstalled, as well as an exhibition that relates to the playground, and specifically an engagement with the city of Pittsburgh.
And there is a lot of time to get into some of the specifics here. We can't talk about all 19 of the artists representing these various countries, but we're going to definitely delve into a couple who are particularly interesting, including a video artist who, when Andrew Carnegie envisioned this whole exhibition, I'm guessing video art was something that he might not have pictured even in his futuristic, thoughtful mind. But this year, the Carnegie International has three curators, the three of you who are here. Do you know what influenced that decision, Dan Byers, and how your individual perspectives have contributed to the development of this year's show?
Well, I know our director, Lindsay Levansky, was very interested in having a conversation, an exhibition that would come out of many different perspectives rather than one monolithic voice. And so she wanted to have a team of curators working together. And it's really meant that, one, we each bring our own perspective. And I always think about a sort of Venn diagram of three overlapping circles where there's places where we overlap or we diverge. And so the show has room for that kind of creative antagonism almost between different perspectives, and that reflects the kind of interesting heterogeneity of the artists in the show as well. So we were really hoping to have a conversation that we could also open up to other people and organize the show in that way.
Daniel Bowman, the last Carnegie International was held in 2008, and there have been many global changes during that time. In our previous segment, we were referring to some of the fallout from the economic downturn that began that year. And so in the time since, what are some of the notable changes that you've seen within the art world?
Well, the art world is a broad, it's a huge place. It spans all over the world, Asia. They have really different problems than we have, or all the challenges. I think what we were interested in was looking back or looking into Pittsburgh. This is an exhibition that doesn't take place in London or Beijing, but it takes place in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we wanted to have this exhibition rooted here. And and so that was one of the first things we started to discuss. How can an exhibition of international ambition, addressing international issues, being appealing to an international audience, having its roots in the city of Pittsburgh?
I think that idea of the specificity of this place was also something that influenced the way we looked at artists from all over the world and really invited artists and projects that could reflect something specific from the place that they come from, but also have an impact on a kind of global level. And one thing that's changed, if you think about the economic downturn since 2008, is, you know, in the past, shows like this, you ship objects, huge objects, all around the world, and that obviously costs a lot of money. And of course, we've done a lot of that, but we also decided that we would ship artists rather than only objects. So many artists have come from all over the world to actually make work here, and we wanted to just give them space to do here rather than just encourage the shipping industry, basically.
Yeah, well, in the past, international curators have racked up hundreds of thousands of air miles traveling to see artists. And I understand that you did not do as much traveling this time. Is that a function of philosophy or necessity?
Well, you know, by some accounts, we did a lot of travel. But just by the sheer relationship that we have to the internet today, that we have been able to investigate artists and, let's say, local scenes in cities like Rio de Janeiro or in Beirut from afar. So if we were able to travel there, our time is much more targeted, in essence. You can sort of get by with a couple days if you've done enough internet research prior to your trip.
But just to be clear, I mean, I think we actually visited as many or more places than previous curators, but because there were three of us, we were able to split up the globe. So we were all over the Middle East and South America and Asia and Europe, and that travel was important. I think what Tina said is right, though, is that it was really targeted and we really wanted to concentrate on certain cities where we knew that there were interesting things.
It's the Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with the three Carnegie International 2013 curators, Dan Byers, whom you just heard, Daniel Bowman, and also Tina Kukelski. And Daniel brought up an interesting point earlier, saying that, you know, while this show draws viewers from around the world, it still has to live in Pittsburgh. How have you helped the artists to connect with the city as they create their work?
So some of the artists came, or a lot of the artists actually came to visit Pittsburgh and spent their time here and discovered the city. And for some of them, it produced interesting projects. For instance, Tobias Madison, a young artist from Switzerland, he worked and during 1 week with an after-school class from Wilkinsburg. They produced a film together, actually three films that will be on display in the Grand Staircase. And there are other projects that rooted themselves in the city and then developed from there into other projects.
One major installation is the Playground Project, which is to be displayed outside the museum entrance. And Daniel, I know that you are involved with this. You're overseeing this. It sounds fascinating. What is the story behind it?
Well, it started with a very simple observation that when I came to Pittsburgh, I walked down Forbes Avenue and I saw these few lit trees, quite sad trees next to the museum. And I thought, oh, if only there could be a little bit more life here.
They were lit? What kind of trees were you saying they were?
There were sad trees, like old trees, not really nice trees, next to the museum's entrance and some bushes. And I thought there should be more life in there. So I suggested to the museum, a bit jokingly, well, let's do a playground. And then everybody got really enthusiastic about this idea. And then I thought, well, let's do it then. And so we could open it last April. And it was also a way of showing people that the international we are working on, it is a very serious show, but it has also moments of surprise. Surprises. It is a show that is not always conventional, that takes some risks and that really is addressed to the audience. It wants to bring people in. It talks to the people in the streets. We're building a huge installation outside at the moment that will even be bigger than that playground. So it is a sign out to the city, the community, to the street. Come in, let's see that show and let's talk about it together.
It's such a serendipitous thing that you just happened to mention that off the cuff and with no intention of necessarily wanting to create that for the international, and yet here it is.
Well, I would say that there happened to be a ton of fascinating research that Daniel and Gabi, the curator of the project, had put together on the history of artists and architect design playgrounds after the Second World War to the present. So there's also an incredible exhibition that brings together models and images and films of playgrounds from all over the world.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that when we talk about what we want art to be, we found that the playground was actually an empowering metaphor for that. And I think that, you know, it sets the stage sort of at the outset before you walk in that art can be about things related to experimentation and innovation and maybe this other thing that we call risk. And we find that most of the artists in the show are dealing with one of those issues, or those issues one way or the other.
In keeping with Andrew Carnegie's vision for the Carnegie International, he, again, back in 1896, when he was coming up with the concept for this, he said, you know, we're looking for a way to find the old masters of tomorrow. And that may have been also with an eye toward not necessarily trying to attract the contemporary artists of 1896 who were established, but finding new visionaries. How have you kept the idea of finding the old masters of tomorrow in mind as you've built this year's show, Dan?
I think there's two different ways. One is that we are really interested in the way that that idea of the old masters of tomorrow actually was a very strategic and practical strategy for Carnegie to build the collection of the museum. So the idea was just to, rather than having to fill in with old masters that cost a lot of money, you start with the people making artwork now, and it really made the museum one of the first museums with a contemporary art focus in the country. And so we were really interested in that relationship between the collection and then this exhibition that happens every 3 or 4 years. So this ephemeral event and then the collection, which, you know, is meant to live forever in the city. So that's one reason we organized this exhibition of the museum's collection as part of the International, to highlight that relationship between the museum, the exhibition, and the collection. But then to look at how we're sort of attending to the old masters of tomorrow today.
Which really, when you think of it, that Carnegie was maybe envisioning the economic model that many a museum might be in these tough economic times following today, because it is, let's face it, it's cost efficient.
No, absolutely. And you work with there's a sort of speculative logic built into the idea. And we're interested in artists who we feel are – whose voices are most relevant and urgent today. But it was also our desire to break up this monolithic list of future art stars into a really interesting list of artists who could have conversations together, and then to bring in these other projects that would create a context around them.
Yeah, so we have also two artists. We have two artists who are not alive anymore. So they – just to say that
artists of yesterday.
Yeah, the artists of yesterday can actually be the artists of tomorrow's too.
Well, how will this year's International shape the collection moving forward, Tina?
We've already begun. We have held back on the coffers for at least a year in terms of our acquisition funds in anticipation that there would be so much new work being generated out of this show and that we had to sort of wait and see. So just this summer, we began acquiring a couple works, and we hope to acquire works by as many artists in the show as we possibly can, which might be almost all of them.
And what are some of the ways that you have or are helping the artists to connect with the city of Pittsburgh? We touched upon that earlier, but there are some other things, that other aspects of this show that we haven't covered yet that sort of speak to that connection, a way of telling people why this should matter to them.
I think in some ways the artists have helped us connect to Pittsburgh rather than vice versa. So many artists were interested in doing projects that had some relationship to the city, and it's led us to get to know the puppeteering community here, a community in Homestead, a community in Braddock. And I'm referencing, for instance, Zoe Strauss, who's created a portrait studio in Homestead and is taking portraits of residents there and creating a large-scale installation at the museum. And she's an incredible artist and charismatic personality and deeply caring as well. And she's actually given us kind of entree into Homestead, and the same with a project in Braddock by a local artist collective named Transformasium. So they've really, I think, helped us engage with the city as much as we've made any kind of introduction.
I would just add that I think that we did, in some sense, create an environment in which artists were able to think differently about their engagement with the museum. And so maybe you have this expectation as an artist coming to do a big international show where you'll be, you know, admitted into the museum, the sort of the monolith, you know. And one of the things that we did was to create an apartment space in the neighborhood of Lawrenceville. And that was sometimes one of the first places that some of the artists who came to town would visit. And we would invite other people from the arts community. And really that was a way for us to introduce our neighbors to these artists that were coming in from the outside. So I think it did inspire artists to sort of think differently and about the ways that the museum can function in terms of an arts community locally.
We're talking about the Carnegie International, which is opening at the Carnegie Museum of Art next month on October 4th. And it comes around roughly every 4 years. Some people say 3 to 5. So I guess it's not always every 4, but just about. And so that means that since 2008, people have been waiting for this and eagerly anticipating what's to come. And I wanted to talk about some of the artists and some of the installations that are coming. And, you know, as I said earlier, one of the things Andrew Carnegie might not have been able to envision from his perspective in 1896 when he started this was the concept of video art. But it is something, an area that is growing and holds a real fascination for people in this digital day and age, which makes the creation of video art so much more accessible than it may have once been. And you have an artist who is coming named Yael Bartana, I'm hoping I'm saying the name correctly, from Israel, who lives in Tel Aviv and Amsterdam, a video artist. Tell me a little bit about this particular installation. We'll go with Daniel on this one.
So the piece is called Summer Camp, and it shows a group of Israeli and Palestinian and international activists going into rebuilding houses by Palestinians that had been destroyed by the Israeli army. It is an almost desperate gesture because they built the house all together and then it's again destroyed afterwards. But it is it's a political protest, and the Albertana uses the rhetoric of propaganda film and turning actually that language upside down. So you're seeing something that you might know, but it's used for another purpose, and you start to figure out what is going on, what exactly is this film talking about. And it's a quite provocative film, so I think it is important. We want to do an exhibition that you come in and you are challenged, because you're not paying $17 to be bored, right?
No, and this sounds anything but boring. But when you talk about turning the concept, Daniel, when you talk about turning the concept of a propaganda film more or less on its head, explain what, for people who don't know, exactly what the aim of a propaganda film is, and then how you would sort of turn that inside out in an artistic way.
So in this case, Yael Bartana uses a film from, I think, 34 or 35, calling people to come to Israel and build a new country, build a new nation. And she takes the same music, but also the same filmic language to talk about the opposite almost. And so so what you first see in this projection, you first see the film where they rebuild the Palestinian house. And this is then followed by the second film, by an excerpt of the second film from 35, showing the exact same but for the opposite activity. So this is, it's something we're interested in, is history and how to read history upside down.
That was Daniel Bowman, and he is one of the three Carnegie International 2013 curators who is visiting with us here on Essential Pittsburgh in our Studio A, along with Daniel Bowman, Dan Byers, and Tina Kukalski. Again, all three are the curators of this year's 2013 Carnegie International. There is another artist closer to home who lives in Philadelphia named Zoe Strauss. And this sounds like a fascinating individual, an installation artist and photographer who holds an annual one-woman exhibit called Under I-95, displayed under Interstate 95 in South Philadelphia. Tell us about this particular artist, Dan.
So I first became familiar with Zoe Strauss's work when I used to live in Philadelphia, and she is an incredible photographer, street photographer, and won acclaim in Philadelphia for this exhibition she would hold underneath the highway overpass. And she would spend months cleaning out the space with volunteers, and then would hold this major exhibition that was highly choreographed in the way it was arranged on all of the poles and columns underneath the highway. And these are striking images of people from her neighborhood, and she would sell them for $5. So we were really interested in the way that she explored place through people and the kind of rough beauty of her photography, and wanted to see what she would do here in Pittsburgh. And upon her invitation, she told me immediately that she would do a project in Homestead. She's a very major labor activist as well, and was very interested in the labor history of Homestead and its relationship to Carnegie Steel and the steel industry there as well. So she's basically spent the last 2 years as a historian unearthing documents and stories from eBay and from people directly about Homestead, about the history there, about the strike, and has decided to explore that history also through the conditions today. So as a photographer, rather than going out into the street and taking pictures of people, which is how she normally makes work, she decided to invite people into a portrait studio that she's opened on 8th Avenue in Homestead. And she's basically there every day welcoming anyone. There's a great collection of books she's put together on photography, contemporary art, history, Homestead, the steel industry. And she's also sent a colleague and friend of hers to China to take footage in a steel factory there. And that footage will be integrated into an installation at the museum that involves both around 200 portraits of Homestead residents, as well as projections, sort of linking the contemporary situation with very new industrial cities in China and the steel industry there with the history of Homestead and the people who live there now.
And Zoe Strauss is a fascinating woman in many ways. One of the things that is particularly striking about her background is that she was not trained in photography. She did not graduate from college. She took only one photography course at a community college when she was a teenager. How representative is this of maybe some of the other artists who are part of this who don't necessarily have any particular – who aren't classically trained, if you will, but who nevertheless are excelling in what they do? Tina.
I think that all the artists in our show have a shared ambition and belief in what they do. And I think for us as curators, we're not necessarily inspecting their CV to see where they graduated from. I think that, you know, Zoe's project, as Dan described it, under the I-95 highway, was the kind of project that was so the opposite of perhaps what an art student might be doing, because she really was so much embedded in the community that she is from and the community that she has such strong ties to. That was enough for us to sort of believe in its potential. So I think that, you know, what the artists have in common is, again, just relentless ambition.
And does that kind of sum up – because it's hard to really – this is such an art behemoth, the International, that it's hard to sum up – In a few words, exactly what it's about. But if anything describes what is at the heart and the core of this, is it artists like Zoe, or the fact that these people may not have the training necessarily, but they have the passion and they're doing great work?
Certainly, yes. But also what we really believe, and we're sometimes shy to say it, it's really art that can change lives, that can improve your life, that can make a real difference that talks about the incredible diversity we're living in and thus embrace it. So, for instance, one of the artists is Joseph Joachim, who died in 72, and he is what people call self-taught. Now, I mean, you could say Zoe Strauss is self-taught as well. You could say the same of Zanele Moholi, South African photographer, who went to one school, like a self DIY, almost a DIY school. You could even say it from by Wade Guyton, who just went to college and had to meet an interesting teacher and then build up almost his own education from there. So this idea of an artist as being a professional coming out of art school is certainly true, but it's not exactly what we're interested in.
Yeah, I think
that brings up an interesting question, is that as curators, what are you interested in? And what are the things – you know, when you go out and you're looking for something, do you know what you're looking for? Or are you allowing something to find you?
Well, I think it's that combination of something that draws you in for, you know, aesthetic or formal reasons, but then some content behind it which is passionate and engaged and kind of rough and human. And I think this kind of dichotomy that we've been talking about between the kind of self-trained or self-taught and the polished and professional, many artists represent in our show kind of have both. And I think going back to Zoe, just as an example, you have someone who's basically self-taught and whose work comes from this kind of intuitive passion, but on the other hand is a magnum photographer and has had, you know, photographs published in the New York Times Magazine and all over. And so the work kind of functions both on a really shrewd, refined aesthetic level, but then at the same time has this kind of directness. And I think many of the artists in the show function in both of those realms, and we were really interested in that.
Tina, I'll let you have the final word that may entice someone who is curious about coming to the Carnegie International next month.
Yeah, well, for me, I think it's about challenging myself to remain open to the unknown.
Sure.
And so seeing a work of art, and if it sparks a set of questions in me, then it's probably worth investigating further. So it's about sort of remaining open enough and also as well as you can be aware of your own sort of limitations. That's what it's about for me.
Well, we can't wait. It's coming up October 4th again. The exhibition opens, the Carnegie International at the Carnegie Museum of Art. We've been speaking with the three Carnegie International 2013 curators, Daniel Bowman, Dan Byers, Tina Kukowski, joining us here in Studio A. Thank you all for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you,
Our
Paul.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, on NCAA athletes who feel they should be paid. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.